Historically, thousands of murders are classified as unsolved across the UK. Modern forensic techniques help families find justice even after decades have passed. I'm Wensley Clarkson, and you're listening to the Real Silent Witnesses podcast from Graphic Audio, a podcast series that delves into the scientific leaps in forensics. In each episode, we'll meet forensic experts and journalists who work tirelessly to help families that deserve answers. And we'll examine the techniques that help solve the most difficult cold cases. Throughout the show, you'll hear extracts from my book, The Real Silent Witnesses. This is The Real Silent Witnesses, The Body Farm. My guest today, John Jefferson, is a pretty unique character when it comes to the world of forensics. He co-wrote a series of best-selling novels with the legendary forensic scientist, Dr. Bill Bass, who invented The Body Farm in Tennessee, where decomposed corpses are left to rot in the name of medical science. I'm hoping John can take us on a journey into the world of the body farm and all the other elements of this that have become such a crucial part of the forensic investigative process and helped inspire the novels he's written with Bill Bass. Hello, John. How are you?
I'm good. Nice to meet you, Wensley. I'm delighted to be here.
Even all these years later, since Bill Bass first opened his body farm, it still has a feeling of being very unique, even though there are others around the world. But let me ask you, first of all, John, you're a journalist by trade. I think you originally specialised in scientific subjects. So how did you get interested in this specifically? And at what stage did you decide with Bill Bass that you could turn his know-how and your writing skills into a series of bestsellers?
Back in the 1990s, I did about a five-year stint as a television documentary writer and producer. And I was making these sort of high-end travel shows for the Arts and Entertainment Network. We jokingly called them travel porn because there would be all these shots of chandeliers and fancy old hotels and coffered ceilings and marble columns and so on. And, you know, it was a good living and I got to go to some amazing places. But after a while, you know, you can only write about opulent chandeliers so many times before you start to get a little bored. And I started thinking, well, what would I rather make documentaries about? And I came back to science because I had been a science writer for some years, and I've always loved science. And I lived in Knoxville, Tennessee at the time, which is where the body farm is. And I thought, well, that would be an interesting documentary. So I called Bill Bass. You know, he didn't know me from Adam, but he talked to me and he said, you know, that sounds like a really good idea. So, but eventually the National Geographic Channel took not just a 1-hour show, but 2 1-hour shows. And it was turned into this amazing adventure in creating a documentary.
I realize we haven't really explained to the listeners what The Body Farm is. In recent years, I've researched The Body Farm while writing my audiobook. Let's hear about it.
On a scrubby, run-down, abandoned plot of fenced-off land in the countryside just outside South Knoxville in Tennessee lies one of the most important forensic facilities in the world. For on these barren fields and among the shabby outhouses is a unique anthropology research centre which contains more secrets of the dead than probably anywhere else in the world. It generates data on tissue and bone degradation under controlled conditions. It also allows for chemical changes in the soil, air, and water around the corpse, which helps forensic scientists to establish the location of a murder or serious crime with much more ease. This place is commonly called the Body Farm, although others have somewhat flippantly dubbed it a chilling, surreal theme park for the dead, in recognition of Hollywood horror films like Night of the Living Dead. Body farms are better known in the world of forensic science as forensic cemeteries or taphonomy facilities, after the discipline devoted to the study of decay and fossilization. In one corner of this land, the remains of what appears to be a body sit in an abandoned vehicle. In another area, a corpse has been buried just beneath the surface of the ground to replicate the way investigators believe the person was killed. But these dead bodies are not models from a movie set. They're real corpses who are giving up secrets which may eventually lead to the arrest and conviction of their killers. It's said the wind is never strong in these parts, which is just as well because if a strong gust came through here, some of those old bones would be sure to be disturbed. World-renowned forensic anthropologist William Bass opened this outdoor facility back in 1981, specifically to study how human bodies decompose. Many believe that it has since helped revolutionize certain areas of forensic research. Not surprisingly, it's a bizarre place where the dead literally dominate the surroundings. The body farm's specially donated human remains are decaying in controlled environments, which Bass and his team of forensic scientists believe will help investigators to work out the fate of crime victims. Dr. Bass set it all up in the belief that it would enable investigators to unravel the truth about why bodies decompose in differing circumstances and what they can tell scientists about everything from time of death to the reasons behind why a death occurred. The facility was inspired by American bone collections dating back to the 19th century, although those human bones are of no use to today's forensic researchers. Bodies have changed in the past 100 to 150 years due to diet and general standards of living, so modern skeletons are vital to today's body farm. More than 100 corpses are donated to the facility every year. Some individuals pre-register before their own death. Other bodies are donated by their families or a medical examiner. Most inhabitants of William Bass's body farm usually become so decomposed that only their bones remain. And that is the crucial condition for Bass and his researchers. It takes an average of 2 years for those corpses to end up being a skeleton. These remains are cleaned, recorded, and carefully labeled before being officially enrolled into this unique facility for the dead.
These were my personal findings on the subject, but what is your experience of the body farm? How would you describe it?
So the body farm is about a 3-acre plot of land that adjoins the University of Tennessee Medical Center parking lot in Knoxville, Tennessee. It's up on a wooded hillside overlooking the Tennessee River. It would be a great piece of real estate, except for all the rotting bodies on it. But bodies are put there, donated human bodies are put there, and they're allowed to decompose. And the decomposition process is closely studied. They're researching what happens to the body after death. When does it happen? When do various changes happen? And how do different factors such as temperature and humidity and the setting the body is in, how do those affect the rate of decay? And the reason they're studying that is so that if a body's found, somewhere out in the wilds, in Sussex or wherever, scientists who have access to the data from the body farm studies can look at the state that body's in when it's found, if it's not fresh. And they can estimate with surprising accuracy when that person died or was killed. And that's important in helping figure out if it's a murder. It's important to have a timeline so that if you have a potential suspect who's got, alibis for certain periods of time, but not for other periods of time, you can see if they could have killed this person when, in fact, the person was killed.
And a lot of this is down to the size of the maggots and I think it takes them a week to be fully gorged, if that's the right word.
you have done some research, Winsley. So yeah, well, that partly depends on the temperature as well. I mean, so it all these factors interrelate in a complicated way. So yeah, the life cycle of the blowfly and the maggot is a crucial tool, and in fact, developing forensic entomology, as it's called, use of insects to help investigate crimes, that was really pioneered at the body farm in Tennessee. The very first research project they did in 1981 was looking at insects and corpses. What bugs come to feed on a body? When do they come? What's the succession? Which different bugs show up at different points in the decay of a body?
I presume it depends on where the body is and what the temperature is like.
Right, exactly. So in winter, if the temperatures are below 50 degrees, That's roughly the rule of thumb. Blowflies aren't active. They don't fly. So they're not going to go land on a body and lay eggs that then hatch into maggots that then start munching on the body. If it's hot, on the other hand, you know, in a summer in Tennessee, when the temperature is up in the 90s, hot and humid. I mean, if you step off an airplane into Knoxville, Tennessee on a summer day, it's like you stepped into a steam bath. But at the height of summer in Tennessee or other hot places like that, a body can go from freshly killed to bare bone in 2 weeks or less because the flies and the maggots have such a field day.
Does that mean it's harder for forensic scientists to work out when someone was murdered if it occurred in the winter when a body is frozen?
Yeah, it is a bit harder, yeah, because the range, the precision of the estimate is not as great. You know, you might be looking at an estimate instead of saying this person's been dead for 10 to 12 days or 18 to 20 days, you might be saying this person's been dead 3 to 6 months.
I know you've superbly described why it exists and where it is, but what is it like? Can you walk us through just a few minutes of what it feels like the first time you go in? It must be very surreal.
Oh, it absolutely is. So the body farm, as I mentioned, is this 3-acre patch of wooded hillside, but it's surrounded on three sides now by a parking lot as the University of Tennessee Medical Center has grown and grown and grown. Oh, it's so bizarre, right? And I mean, you can literally, if you're late for work at the hospital, you know, the parking place you're going to end up in is the worst parking place, which is right by the gate of the body farm. Bill Bass, as I say, is such a great ambassador. He's a cult figure. He is larger than life. He's almost like a demigod in East Tennessee because his work has been so important around the country and even around the world. So people love the body farm. They just don't love to park next to it and to smell it.
Which is the reality of it is what they find scary. But when you walk in, are you walking straight into a corpse lying in a field? Is there some padding? What happens when you walk in?
It's a pretty abrupt shift. You know, there's a high wooden fence around it so that people outside don't see in. That was put up after a protest in the very early days of the place. No. I mean, why not? So there's this high wooden fence, and then outside the wooden fence, there's a chain link fence that's topped with barbed wire. So that people can't get in. They still occasionally, I don't think it's happened lately, but you know, but there have been a few incidents over the years.
I'm imagining a bunch of kids on Halloween breaking in.
Drunken fraternity pledges, I believe, is the usual offender. But they actually had someone break in and steal, I think, half a dozen skulls some years ago, you know, and to try to sell them on the black market just as oddities. But you walk in this big wooden gate. It's, you know, it's wide enough. It's, you know, probably, you know, 10 feet wide, you know, double chain link gate so that a pickup truck with a body in the back can back into the place to unload a body. You walk in, there's a little clearing just inside the gate. Sometimes there are research studies going on with bodies right out there in that clearing, you know, 20, 30 feet inside the gate.
If you see a body, I don't want to be putting words into your mouth here, but I imagine that you do a double take the first time, but maybe I'm wrong. Because it's so surreal that maybe there's a moment when you actually doubt that what you're seeing is a body. Is that possible?
Well, by the time I went, I had done so much reading and research that it almost felt familiar to me. It almost seemed as if I had been there before. I will tell you the time I did a double take, you know, even after years of visiting there, you know, and seeing bodies, you know, scores of bodies. I walked down a path into the woods, and there were three bodies hanging from nooses. And it stopped me dead in my tracks. I, you know, as a guy who grew up in the American South, bodies hanging from trees, I imagine for anybody that would be a powerful experience. I can't imagine what that experience might have been like for me if I had been a black man rather than a white man. But the research project that was studying was this. In cases of suicide, there was a case that Bill Bass worked years ago where a body was found in the woods, you know, on the ground, skeletonized body, been there quite a while. And people were baffled about what happened. And, you know, and Bill Bass, in his, you know, in his brilliant and humorous way, looks up and he points at a rope over a tree branch, you know, overhead, and says, well, do you think maybe that had something to do with it? So the guy had hanged himself. He'd hung there until the point at which his body had decayed enough, you know, that the skull pulled loose from the neck, and then he fell to the ground. But what they found in this research study was that the skin of the neck, you know, tends to hold the body from the noose even after the spinal column lets go. The skin is strong enough and tough enough. Yeah, but it was just, I had no warning about that. And that was truly, truly surreal.
Wow. I mean, that's, in itself, it just, I mean... I don't know whether they have a, this is my imagination getting carried away. Do they have a megaphone system in case people like go into areas they shouldn't go into, or is it totally open once you're in there?
Oh, once you're in, unless they've changed things recently, once you're in, you know, they do have video surveillance. But basically, because it's, you know, surrounded by this high chain link barbed wire fence, you have to, you know, unless you go in the gate, you know, and the only people who go in the gate are people with keys to the gate and authorization. You know, so unless you work really hard to scramble over a high barbed wire, razor wire fence, you're not going to be in there unless you're supposed to be.
What about the smell, John?
Oh, the smell is really, really strong. Some people try smearing Vicks VapoRub or, you know, some sort of eucalyptus or something under their nose to try to mask it a little bit. But I tried that once and I couldn't tell that it made any difference. I mean, you just have to get used to it.
Can you remember a way, I'm sure you've described it many ways in your novels, but how that sweet, pungent smell, what it's like?
It's basically like stumbling onto a stretch of highway where, you know, 100 dogs and deer and coyotes and possums had been run over and started to rot. I mean, it's... I just find it really terrible. But for me, when I was doing the documentary shooting that I did there, for these National Geographic videos, I was so fascinated by what we were learning that I, you know, it would sort of go to the background channel of my mind.
I'd love to talk about Bill for a minute, and just for you to explain to my listeners, or our listeners rather, who Bill, not just who Bill is, but what he's like as a character, his sense of humor, his aptitude, how he is. I've got a feeling I know the answer, but I'd love to hear it from you.
Yeah, Bill Bass is a great character. He's a great ambassador for science and forensic anthropology and the world's best ambassador for creating a body farm. I mean, it is, you know, creating a body farm isn't something to be, you know, it's not an undertaking, so to speak, for the faint of heart. I mean, it is, you know, it is pretty gory stuff.
Tell me why he's in Unforgettable. What's he like?
So he's a really brilliant scientific investigator. I mean, he, you know, he really looks at a body and a crime scene as a puzzle. So he really is kind of relentless about figuring out what has happened when a body's found. But he, for a guy who's up to his elbows in death and dismemberment, he really has a remarkably jolly outlook on life, a wonderful sense of humor. One of the things he and I always enjoy is bad puns. We never met a bad pun either of us didn't like. So he's, you know, I mean, when he talks to audiences, and he does a lot, he's 92 now, but he's still, and before the pandemic at least, and I suspect now that it's kind of winding down in the States a bit, he's always done a lot of talks for people, and people absolutely adore hearing him talk. He has people learning a lot, asking questions, but also just laughing again and again.
He's been absolutely brilliant, Bill Bass, at forming relationships, or and his staff have, with the families of a lot of the people whose corpses end up in the body farm. Here's a reading from the audiobook where I talk about this.
At the center of all this death and destruction are the families of the deceased who donated their bodies, many of whom visit the body farm regularly. At least a dozen relatives come each year. One woman who's visited the bones of her cousin several times explained that being at the body farm provided her with a mixture of science and comfort. "It doesn't feel morbid or sad," she insisted. Most of the families who visit the body farm meet the scientists to discuss forensic anthropology and how and why their relatives' remains are being used in research or training. Some even request a viewing of their relatives' bones. That's when scientists, including Dr. Bass, talk to them and explain about the intricate side of the science. Many families are initially unsure, but eventually come away happy to have donated their family's bodies. On a few occasions, relatives have even been known to ask to see the bones taken out of their box and arranged as a skeleton on a table covered in protective padding. One forensic scientist who's visited the body farm explained, "One of the most impressive aspects of the facility is the brilliant way they deal with the relatives of the dead. Everything is done with the utmost respect and patience." The same scientist recalled that he came away convinced that every family was proud that their loved one had ended up contributing to such imperative forensic science questions. And the demographics of the corpses at the body farm is fascinating. The majority of skeletons, about two-thirds, are those of white men, and most of them are from inside the Tennessee area and tend to be in their 50s. But there are other relatively young and extremely old remains, which apparently surprises many who visit the body farm. This includes a 16-year-old, as well as the remains of a 101-year-old man. Less well known is the fact that this facility houses the bodies of cremated, unpulverized remains and a small collection of infant skeletons. This includes a small collection of infant and stillbirth skeletons from 20 weeks gestation to 2 months old.
While writing my audiobook, I noticed that Dr. Bass was always very sensitive towards families, and yet he's managed to persuade a lot of people to give permission for their relatives' bodies to be in the body farm, because this is so important for research. Is that a measure of what he's like and his staff and how they deal with such sensitive areas?
Yeah, you know, they haven't been able to do it now, but for years they had an annual memorial service, basically commemorating the people who've given their bodies for research and inviting family members who were close enough to be able to come to that service. It's basically just a chance to say again, thank you. This is so important and helpful. You know, in my experience with forensic anthropologists in general, and I know a lot of them now, my experience with all of them has been that they are very grateful to people who are willing to donate their bodies for research, and that they're also committed to serving as advocates for crime victims, you know, because the dead person can't advocate for themselves any longer. And so they are the voice for the dead person. If they can figure out how this person was killed and can help bring someone to justice, then that's, you know, that's part of their mission.
It's a fantastic achievement on their part to enable families to understand and appreciate why this side of forensic science is so important, which then allows them to give permission to donate their bodies to science. Besides, there are also some families that Bill Bass helped by identifying the bodies of loved ones who'd gone missing. I'd like you to talk me through the case of Leoma Patterson and its relevancy to the body farm. But before we do that, here's an extract from my audiobook to help set the scene.
Since opening the body farm in the early 1980s, Dr. Bass has helped solve dozens of cases. But one of them perfectly illustrates why his facility is so crucial to forensic science, whatever the eventual outcome of a case. Leoma Patterson. Back in 1978, 56-year-old Leoma Patterson left a bar in Clinton, Tennessee, never to be seen again. She literally disappeared into thin air. 6 months later, a female skeleton was discovered in a wood on the edge of a lake in a neighboring county. The bones found buried in the ground seemed to match the missing woman, and one of Patterson's daughters recognized a ring found at the death scene as belonging to her mother. But it wasn't until 6 years later that a relative of Patterson's, one of the men she was last seen alive with, confessed to killing her. It seemed to be an open and shut case in the end, although other relatives of Patterson's were not convinced he'd done it. In 2005, those same relatives persuaded Dr. Bass to re-examine the disputed remains and collect DNA samples, which could not have been done at the time of the prosecution. It would turn out to be a murder case that would test his knowledge of forensic anthropology. In the end, Dr. Bass turned to mitochondrial DNA testing to determine whether Leoma Patterson was really in the grave, because it was much more sensitive than the usual DNA tests. A sample was eventually extracted from the skeleton and compared to the DNA of two of Leoma's daughters. The DNA did not come back as a match. The chapter ended with Dr. Bass bringing back the bones to the lab to figure out who had been buried in Leoma's grave.
This is a classic example of a cold case that Bill and his team never gave up on. Can you tell me how it all happened and if there have been any developments since my audiobook was published?
It was a case that, in fact, he wasn't involved in originally. The Tennessee Bureau of Investigation called a medical examiner to the scene, a physician who's a pathologist, and he collected the bones and took them back to his lab and cleaned them up. They took the dress and the ring, into custody, and the agent who was investigating the case, they knew that this woman had gone missing, Leoma Patterson had gone missing. And so they asked the medical examiner, could these be her bones? And he measured the bones and he says, well, these are the bones of a white female of middle age, and the height is consistent with Leoma Patterson's reported height. And then the TBI agent showed the ring and the dress to one of the daughters of this woman. And she says, yes, those were my mother's. And so, reasonably enough, they identified her. This is before DNA, so they couldn't do what's called a positive identification. They did a presumptive identification. They said, we presume this to be Leoma Patterson. And so she was buried in a small family cemetery way up in the mountains of East Tennessee. And, that was mostly that. But some of the family never fully believed that that was her. They thought that the police had been in too big a hurry to close the case. And so there were some doubters in the family all along. Well, time goes by, DNA technology emerges, and one of the granddaughters of this woman, Leoma Patterson, is taking a chemistry class at the University of Tennessee. And guess who comes in as a guest lecturer one day? Dr. Bill Bass. And she says to herself, if anybody could tell us for sure whether that really is, my grandmother who was found on that lake shore, it's this guy. So the family gets in touch with Bass, asks him would he consider taking this case, and he agrees. And so they get an exhumation order to dig up the remains. Bill and I and one of his graduate students went up there in his pickup truck. We had a generator on in the back of the truck. The cemetery was so remote that the family member who was leading us up there got lost. It took us a while even to find it. But the coffin was exhumed. The bones were in the coffin. They were really in remarkable condition. I mean, 25 years, and it was absolutely bare bone. All of the flesh was gone. And it was, it's actually maybe an odd term. It was a beautiful skeleton. This very graceful, delicate skull. She had all of her teeth, which was kind of surprising. Because as we understood it, Leoma Patterson had never been to a dentist in her life. But so we take the bones out, and Bill is explaining things as a lifelong teacher. He's explaining to the family, and there were probably a dozen relatives of hers up there, including several daughters and a son and some grandchildren. So he's explaining, as he's looking at the skull and the bones, he's explaining what he sees. And, he says, this does look like a Caucasian woman, middle age. He said, "I see, you know, this interesting pattern to the teeth." He says, "Was your, you know, was Leoma part Native American?" And they said, "Well, yeah, she was supposedly one quarter Cherokee Indian." And he says, "The reason I ask you that is because there's a pattern to the upper incisors, the middle front teeth. They're called shovel-shaped incisors. The back edges are slightly cupped instead of being flat across the back." So he says, this really seems consistent with her, but let's take a DNA sample and we'll send it off to a lab so that we can know for sure. So he had brought an autopsy saw, a striker saw. And so, you know, I'm holding a femur while he cuts a cross section of femur and then a humerus, which is the upper arm bone. This is outside, right, powered by this generator in the back of his pickup truck. I'm bracing these bones as he's cutting the cross sections. I'm bracing. We did not have a tent, no. I'm holding these on top of a tombstone just to brace them while he's bearing down with the saw. And then also the graduate student who had come with us, she had brought a 3D digitizing probe. And so she measured all the bones and all these points on the skull, and she fed all those data points into a computer program, which was developed at the University of Tennessee in conjunction with the Body Farm, called 4DISC, which stands for Forensic Discrimination Function. This is a very data-driven program. There are measurements from literally thousands of other skeletons in there. And so the computer compares these measurements, you know, with all, you know, that are taken up there on the mountainside with all these thousands of other measurements. You know, and in it says, you know, there's a 97 or something percent chance that, yes, that this is a Caucasian woman. There's a slight chance of some Native American ancestry. And so all this fits, you know. And so Bill gives the two cross sections of bone to one of the relatives because they're going to pick a DNA lab and send it off for analysis. Everything, all the bones get put back in the coffin. It gets reburied. And, you know, we say our goodbyes. 6 months later, we're stunned when the DNA lab says, you know, the DNA in those bone samples doesn't match the saliva sample that the daughter sent. So these two people are unrelated. We were absolutely stunned. So then the people in the family who had doubted the identification all along, you know, felt vindicated, and, you know, and everybody was upset. So at this point, the district attorney reopens the murder case, the criminal investigation, because, you know, they had closed the case when the identification of Leon Patterson was made. So now they reopen it, you know, and so Bill and I are looking at each other and thinking, well, you know, so if that's not Leoma, who is it? So we go back up to the cemetery. We can find it this time and dig her up again. And we bring the skull back to the university and we get a forensic facial reconstruction artist to do a clay on the skull reconstruction to see what this mystery woman, whom we're now calling Not Leoma, we get this artist to do a facial reconstruction of Not Leoma. And the day she called me to say she was finished with it, I walked into the lab and my jaw dropped. I said, my God, that's a dead ringer for one of Leoma's daughters, Barbara. And so there was another forensic anthropologist, and I pulled out the picture of Leoma Patterson that I had, and another anthropologist in the lab looks at it. She says, well, I see the resemblance, but she said, the DNA says it's not her, so it can't be her. So then we think, all right, well, you know, so what else can we do? And so, you know, we think, well, we'll, you know, put this out there and see if anybody recognizes this person. But then we thought, you know, there's another technique we can do, which is called facial superimposition. And that in that technique, you take an image of the skull and a photograph of the person, and you superimpose the two, and you see if things like the eye orbits or the eye sockets and the, you know, the nasal opening and the line of the chin and the jaw, you see if those things line up. And so we do that. We should have done this first because we had to take the clay. We had to take the clay back off, which kind of broke my heart because it was such a beautiful reconstruction. But we took the clay off. You know, we set it up with two cameras, two video cameras in the University of Tennessee Public Television Station studio. And it took us about an hour to get everything lined up. But when we switched from one camera, when we dissolved swapped the image from one camera to the other. It was really uncanny how precisely everything lined up. And at that point, you know, Bill said, well, I'll be damned. I think you're right. I think it is her. But what's up with the DNA, right? So I took the DNA report that the lab had sent, and I showed it to a new forensic, a new molecular anthropologist that the university had just hired, somebody who specializes in ancient and degraded DNA. And she looked at the report, she frowned, she said, this report isn't worth the paper it was written on. She says, you know, I can tell from this column right here that the sample was contaminated. So so then, you know, we explained this to the family, but they're not having any of it at this point. They've become, you know, professional skeptics or cynics. So we're thinking, well, gosh, what do we, you know, what do we do now? So we thought, well, let's send another sample to a better lab. So we did that. And, you know, I waited a while and wasn't hearing anything from the guy. So, you know, I called him and he said, you know, I'm having to rerun the samples because I'm having trouble getting DNA from the sample. So this goes on for weeks and he tries seven times. He can never find any DNA in the samples. And we send him a bigger piece of bone. We send him a tooth and he can't find anything. So I thought, wow, what's up with that? So I called, you may remember I mentioned that there had been a medical examiner at the crime scene who took the bones back and cleaned them up. So I called this guy who's now, you know, ancient and, you know, and is starting to lose his faculties. And I said, Dr. Blake, do you remember this case? And he says, yeah. I said, so when you took those bones back to your lab and cleaned them up, I said, what'd you do? What was your process? He says, well, I just put them in a big pot with some bleach and some detergent, and I just boiled them for a couple of days. So he had destroyed all the DNA in the skeleton. And we thought, oh, God. You know, we're never gonna get an answer. And then I thought, oh wait, you know, there was a hair mat in the crime scene photos. When you die out in the wilds, after a few days, your scalp sloughs off of your skull and leaves what's called a hair mat. And I had seen in the original crime scene photos the hair mat draped over some twigs. And so I said, Dr. Blake, what about the hair mat? I said, I saw that in the crime scene photos. He said, oh, well, I never had that. The TBI guy would have taken that. I didn't have any need for that. So I called the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation agent up, and I said, do you remember, you know, would the TBI lab, crime lab, still have the hair mat? He said, oh, no, they don't have space to keep anything. You know, so my heart sank all over again. But then a couple of weeks later, he called me and he said, you know, after we talked, I got to thinking and I went down to the basement and I looked in my filing cabinet and I have got that hair mat. So he brought the hair mat to us in Knoxville and we cut a plug of hair and scalp tissue from this hair mat because that hadn't been boiled in bleach. Yeah, and we sent that off to a DNA, to this better DNA guy. And bang, bingo, it was full of DNA and it was full of Leoma Patterson's DNA. So she had been there all along, but we just hadn't been able to prove it until after all these twists and turns.
The only good news for that is I now know what to do if I want to avoid anybody being able to identify a body by DNA. I've just got to boil all the bones in bleach.
So, but they're going to be tracking you. The police will be tracking your bleach purposes now that purchases now that you've said this.
That's absolutely true. Listen, that was fascinating because it's sort of, instead of it being a quick hit, that case, you've explained it all. And I think it's so important for people to understand how long the process can be and how determined the forensic scientists have to be and the researchers and the other people involved if they're going to get to the truth ultimately. It's too easy for the police to say that, you know, they think they've done their bit and they've got a conviction and they should just go ahead. I think it's so important to have that issue always there in the background that the scientists are capable of re-examining and coming up with the truth, because obviously that's the most important thing. You know, it looks like finally here in the UK, authorities have realised the importance of body farms and they're planning to open one here. Let's look at this more closely.
In the UK, forensic scientists are currently working alongside the British military to construct a similar body farm-type facility to the one opened all those decades ago by Dr. Bill Bass. Many inside the world of forensic science say this UK-based version is long overdue. Details about the UK body farm are top secret for sensitivity reasons, but law enforcement sources say that the work first started in late 2019 to develop this unique research facility. In the summer of 2020, rumours emerged that the UK body farm was being located on land close to the UK Defence Ministry's most well-known scientific site, the Defence Science and Technology Laboratory at Porton Down, near the city of Salisbury in southern England. This long-standing facility analyses everything from chemical weapons to poisons to viruses. Porton Down even hosts training sessions for cadaver dogs to find human corpses and has in recent years invested heavily in purchasing adjoining land for new laboratory space. It's claimed this land is where the body farm is being developed. The new body farm site was put on ice for at least 6 months following the coronavirus outbreak in the early months of 2020. The facility is expected to be opened by the end of 2021. UK forensic scientists insist that such a facility would undoubtedly provide crucial information to criminal investigations that can't be obtained from one-off studies which are only connected to specific cases. However, a small minority of UK scientists and police have dubbed the planned facility as gruesome and claim that the value to scientific and forensic research is minimal. There are some people out there who see a body farm as some kind of Frankenstein-type project, said one prominent UK forensic expert. Nothing could be further from the truth. Such a place could only help, not hinder, unsolved murders and other serious crimes.
Speaking of future developments, what are, in your opinion, the most important advances in forensic science?
With the rise of genetic databases and old DNA evidence that can now be reanalyzed and, you know, much more sensitively, you know, it's so interesting that so many old crimes are now finally being solved.
It's incredible. I mean, obviously DNA and other things have helped enormously, but I imagine with the body farm, I presume that cold cases, it's a wonderful facility to help solve cold cases. It must be.
Well, so, you know, I mean, certainly new techniques and technologies are coming out of the body farm. You know, they've done studies of ground penetrating radar.
What does that mean? Sorry.
So ground penetrating radar is radar that instead of looking out, you know, into the air, like, for airplanes or ships, it actually looks at disturbances in soil underneath the ground. And so, you know, it's not like X-ray vision that can show you, you know, a clear outline of a body under the ground, but it can show you certainly some disturbance patterns in the soil that, you know, that can be characteristic if you have reason to think that there might be someone buried in a certain area. There's, you know, one of the scientists who's been associated with the facility for years has developed some chemical analysis techniques that look at soil and the byproducts that come out of a body as it decays. You know, and basically he's developed techniques that can read the chemical byproducts of decay almost like a time clock, you know, and he can say because of this change in chemical profile that emerges as a body decays, he can estimate remarkably precisely how long that person's been dead. So that's a new tool that's coming out of the body farm.
Now, there's another side to not just the body farm, but the research and the results of that research, which help enormously when we have disaster mortuary operations. I think they're called in the States, I think, a disaster mortuary operations response team, which are individuals who respond to mass disasters as opposed to not necessarily crimes. And could you just tell the listeners why some of the research that is done at the body farm is so important to this in terms of if bodies are air crash victims or whatever?
both research and training. You know, the Body Farm is an absolutely unique training facility for crews, these DMORC crews and other law enforcement teams to work, with actual human bodies in a realistic setting. There was a great training not too long after the 9/11 terrorism attacks in the U.S. They did a big DMORT training exercise in Knoxville where the scenario for the training was radiological terrorist incident. So they presumed that someone had set off a dirty bomb, a radioactive bomb that killed people with radiation. And so the DMORT members who were undergoing this training, they had to decontaminate the bodies a certain way, and they had to, monitor radiation levels. There were simulated radiation sources that they had to work around. I mean, now if there's an airplane crash, unless people are incinerated beyond, to the point that their DNA is gone, DNA is probably, DNA or dental records are probably going to be how they identify people. But, just the training of being able to identify people, whose bodies are unrecognizable.
The state of those bodies in certain parts of that one aeroplane can tell you where, for example, a bomb went off, can't they?
Sure, there's going to be kind of directional trauma to those bodies from the force of a blast. I mean, the aircraft investigators are also going to be looking at those kinds of things as well. But yeah, the face and chest of people who are sitting behind the location of the blast would be disfigured, and then those in front of it, their backs would be more traumatized. So absolutely.
I want to ask you one last question, because forensic thrillers, novels similar to the ones that you've written so successfully, Bill Bass, are not only big in publishing terms, but, in terms of films, podcasts that we're talking about now, TV series. What, in your opinion, sets a Jefferson Bass novel apart from every other novel that covers this subject?
Well, two things, I hope. One is the forensic accuracy. We do take a lot of pride in not wildly exaggerating things for the sake of drama. So accuracy is one thing that I think sets us apart. The other, I think, is just the character of our protagonist, Dr. Bill Brockton, who is closely based actually on both Bill Bass and me. It's, he's got the credentials of Bill Bass, but, he has more of the kind of interior life of me, because it's easier for me to write that. And Bill Bass is a very focused and pragmatic kind of guy, and I'm more ruminative or reflective. And so if you're writing a novel in the first person and you're in the protagonist's interior world, it helps to have some introspection.
How do you decide what to write in subject terms with Bill? Or does he come to you with a mass of material and then you sit and sift through it and decide what works?
Yeah, it's more that latter. I've been through every one of his case files, looking for, all right, what's a really interesting, is there some kind of offbeat angle or a unique angle to a particular crime? And we talk about past cases and, in that light, what were some really dramatic cases? What were some cases that were particularly puzzling? And we also talk about, all right, what forensic techniques haven't we highlighted yet in a novel? Let's bring in something. Let's focus on, say, the effects of fire on flesh and bone. And how do you, what can you learn from a charred skeleton?
So I'm imagining you go away and write the book, which in itself takes many months, I'm sure. And then you go back to Bill and he reads that draft, or do you just show, that's how it works?
He'll read a draft and, he's looking especially for, and I'll talk to him before I get too far into the writing. I'll say, so here's the plot. Here's how I want to take, here's the murder I'm envisioning, and here's, what I envision happening. And you know, invariably he says, well, that sounds great. So it's been...
He sounds like the perfect partner, having journalistically, like you, been through quite a number of partnerships, ghostwriting and things like that. I know this isn't ghostwriting, but there are similarities. It's getting the other person, who's often the star, if you want to call them that, to sign off on things. I think you're very carefully asking the right questions in order to provide the right answers. Is that something you're conscious of?
Yeah, I mean, we do try to, you know, as the old adage goes, instruct and delight. So we are trying to convey knowledge, but then, you know, also not just about forensic science, but I'm always trying to work in some sort of broader issue or theme as well.
Well, one last question, literally. I'm just fascinated by whether when you're discussing certain plot points in this book, because let's face it, I've written fiction as well. You know, you do put yourself in there. And as you've already said, that both of you, the real yous, are in there somewhere in that one character. Do you ever laugh at the fact that something from your childhood or something just gets dropped into the middle of your novel?
Oh, I love that. And, you know, and occasionally there'll be one of those little details that's absolutely from my life. And somebody will say, oh, yeah, I remember Dr. Bass talking about that.
I think that's always a good feeling.
It's a good sign.
Listen, John, you've been fantastic. We've done an hour of absolutely fascinating insight into the body farm, every aspect of it. You've also been brilliant at describing Bill. So I feel as if we've almost got him here with us as well. Thank you very, very much for all your help.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Real Silent Witnesses, The Body Farm. In the last hour, we've chatted with writer John Jefferson about Bill Bass and his extraordinary invention, The Body Farm. I was amazed at the unexpected turn of events during this interview. I wrote about Leoma Patterson in my audiobook. Her case was still unsolved. But during our chat, John Jefferson revealed that the case has recently been solved, and this wouldn't have been possible if the body farm didn't exist. Now the family of Leoma can finally have peace of mind. Obviously, the views and thoughts I've expressed in this podcast are entirely my own. It's a free world. You can think whatever you want. Make sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app so you'll never miss an episode. And while you're at it, if you like the show, we'd appreciate a rating on Apple Podcasts and tell a friend about what you've heard. For a more in-depth analysis into forensics, check out my audiobook, The Real Silent Witnesses, which is available at all good stores, including Audible and Apple Books, published by W.F. Howes. Be sure to tune in next week for our latest episode. And remember, the dead tell us everything.